This episode is sponsored by World History Encyclopedia, one of the top history websites on the internet. I love the fact they're not a wiki. Every article they publish is reviewed by the editorial team, not only for being accurate, but also for being interesting to read. The website is run as a non-profit organization, so you won't be bombarded by annoying ads, and is completely free. It's a great site, and don't just take my word for it. They've been recommended by many academic institutions, including Oxford University. Go check them out at worldhistory.org or follow the link in the episode description. In this episode, the remarkable story of the Nsa Zulu people.
It's a perfect example of human adaptability to physically challenging environment and human resilience to nature. They choose to live in the middle of water, and that's their choice, and that's their culture.
In recent years, this hitherto obscure community have begun to attract more attention from the outside world. Eager to learn more about their origins and their remarkable story, I turn to a Ghanaian expert who's not only researched the community, but he's also visited the remarkable place they call home.
I'm Nana Kese. I'm an African historian. I study the African environment. My objective is to try to understand human and environment relationships, particularly try to understand first Africa's water systems and water bodies and how humans have interacted with those waters over time and how those interactions shape the history of the continent.
Nana, before we get into the community, which is still active today and has been for hundreds of years, I was curious what we know about their origins and the time before they lived there. What drew them there? And why did they decide to build this extraordinary community on stilts in the middle of a river?
In present-day Ghana, precisely the southern part, there is the Akan ethnic group. And Akan is the umbrella name for different ethnicities. Within the Akan umbrella group, you have the Asante, the Fanti, the Kuiapem, the Achim, Dentra, and Zuma. They have their languages. Asantes speak Tri, Fanti speak Fanti, and Zuma people speak Nzima, Kuiapem people speak Kuiapem, Achim, they also speak Tri, that kind of thing. So Zulu is found within the Nzima territory. So essentially, they are part of the Akan ethnic groups, but they precisely reside within the Nzima territory. And for geographical purposes, the Nzima people inhabit the southwesternmost part of present-day Ghana. So if you were to exit Ghana into Ivory Coast, the Nzima territory on the southern part, which abuts on the Atlantic Ocean, will be the Nzima area. So the history of Nzulu people, and if I would dare say the Akan people, can be better understood through oral traditions. Because the origins of these ethnicities far preceded when, quote-unquote, European writings came to the continent. So it is believed that most Akan groups came from the Sahel region of West Africa, the woodland areas and the savanna areas where you would find present-day Mali, Burkina Faso, Chad, going even westward. So Nzulu people explain that the ancestors emigrated from the ancient Mali Empire. It's subject to debate because we do not know for sure. DNA testing might help, but as a historian, I would leave that part to the scientists to do the job. But from historical linguistics and oral traditions that we kind of collect, we know that there was active interactions between the people who lived in the Sahel region, particularly the Mande people. They interacted with the Akan people on the south for several centuries, even before Europeans started circumnavigating the western part of Africa. In my work, I explained that perhaps or probably the Nzulu people emigrated from the Sahel region of the interior part of West Africa and they came downward. But the question is, why would they come southward? And I argue that from the 17th century or even before, the Akan people had been trading with the Mande people in gold, cola, and enslaved people too. So precisely, the Mande people would come far south to purchase gold, they would take it to North Africa. So they sort of served as a conduit for trade between coastal West Africa now and Northern Africa and even the Mediterranean world, all the way to Europe. One of the known popular groups, Mande groups, who came to the Gold Coast were called the Dwala people or the Wangara people. So I speculate that perhaps the Nzulezu people might have been one of these people. According to Nzulezu traditions, they explained that they actually fled the ancient Mali Empire during a time of warfare. If my history serves me right, that would be a time when the ancient Mali Empire was in its declining phase. And we are looking at the second half of the 15th century, all the way to the 16th century. And some scholars argue that, well, the ancient Mali Empire would disintegrate eventually in the 1670s. Some also believe that, well, at the turn of the 1600s, it was already not the superpower it used to be. I speculate again. And again, I'm using speculations because we do not know for sure. But then, if I were to situate the oral traditions in existing historical works, that's the best conclusions I can make. They would have come to the Akan regions of Ghana, precisely to a place they call the Bono region, because the Bono region served as, I would call it, a junction, an entrepot between the Akan mining gold fields on the south and then the Mande people up to the north. And so Bono becomes a very, very integral part of this trade. And the Nzulezu traditions actually make mention of their stay in the Bono region, precisely in Techiman. And they believe that the ancestors lived there for long, married people from there, and sort of had a life. Their fleeing the Mali Kingdom was as a result of a quest to find security and a better livelihood. When they lived in Bono, the Asante Kingdom invaded Bono in 1722, 1723. And that sort of disoriented the political landscape of Bono, allowing or forcing people to disperse. So I argue that that war might have pushed them all the way south to what we call the Gold Coast now. And on the Gold Coast, they came to the central part, Mankasim, and then they started moving westward to what we would say, or what we would classify as Ivory Coast now. And they came to the Nzema region. The question is, why Nzema and nowhere else? And why live on the water and not on land? The available sources explain, and precisely oral traditions, throughout their journey, they were accompanied by their snail deity called Ivu. What Ivu dictated was what they did. And so what we see is a spiritual dimension to their journey. As a historian, I want to believe that we are looking at a time when political transformations were taking place, including the Atlantic slave trade. I want to believe that spirituality alone can't help explain the people's choice. Perhaps the vibrant trading that was taking place on the Gold Coast might have encouraged them to come all the way to the coast to participate in that. If you remember what I said earlier, the Dwala people or the Wangara people from the Mande world were traders, and they were already familiar with the trade along the coast of the Gold Coast of present-day Ghana. And so when Asante destabilized the political landscape in Bono in 1722-23, it is very, very, very likely that these people might have come all the way down to the Gold Coast. The people might have originated or sort of moved out of the ancient Mali Empire as a unit, as a group. In fact, they explained that they moved in 47 clans, coming all the way down. But given the political conditions of the place, it is likely, and their intermarriages with other groups, it is likely that they would have transformed and expanded them all. With Asante's invasion of Bono in 1722, it would have disintegrated them further. So we are looking at a group that had taken on different linguistic capabilities and lost their own along the way. They would have taken on different religious beliefs and also shirked off some of their beliefs. And so it's an amalgamation or a syncretism of cultures moving with these people. They come all the way to Apollonia, which is now Nzema. In the pre-colonial times, they were called Apollonia. Now, Apollonia becomes an attractive site for the Nzulezu people because, one, I argue that perhaps it was one of the safe places to be on the Gold Coast as of then. And as of then is the first half of the 18th century. Apollonia was a kingdom that was sandwiched by large bodies of water. To the east of Apollonia was what we call the Ancobra River. To the west side of Apollonia was the Tano River. And actually, it's a basin, the Tano Ehi Engene River, huge one. And presently, it separates Ghana from Ivory Coast. South of Apollonia was the Atlantic Ocean. And so it's only its northern border that did not have water crossing it together. So I argue that Apollonia seemed like a near island, which also helps to protect the kingdom from external raiders, particularly slave traders. So essentially, Apollonia seemed like a very safe space, but it was also littered with a lot of bodies of water, including the one they live on. And so according to Nzulezu traditions, their deity, Ivu, led them there. And Ivu manifested itself as snail. So when the snail moved, their priest would inform them and they would also move. I want to also believe that because Apollonia was quite safe, it served as a very, very attractive motivation. Also, Apollonia practiced what we would call an open border policy, which allowed it, that is Apollonia, to accept newcomers into its territory. And this is a time when Apollonia was also expanding. It had recently crystallized to become a polity, a kingdom, by the turn of the 1700s. So it is receiving newcomers to sort of also expand. It has this huge territory. So Nzulezu comes into Apollonia. Now, given the dates that I've mentioned, 1722, 23, they move from Bono to the south. But by 1750s, there is this popular Apollonian king, very powerful, King Amishia, who defeats the Dutch three times. And so he makes a very, very huge name for himself. In fact, to the extent that certain Europeans, the Dutch and the British, would call Apollonia by his name. They refer to Apollonia by the king's name. It is believed that the Nzulezu people came at the time when Amishia was king. Amishia, the king, considered them ill-disposed. So he really didn't want to have them live in his community. There is this contemporaneous British official called Henry Meredith who writes that the Nzulezu people pleaded with the king. And the king said, okay, if you want to live in my community, then I can only have you live in the middle of the water. I think that the king was trying to deter them from inhabiting his kingdom. But the people were quite resolute and said, yes, we will do so. We will live in the middle of the water. So here we have two competing ideas. The one, the British governor, from his research informants, writes that, well, the king didn't really find them so appealing. So he asked them to live in the middle of water so that they would be removed from his citizens. But Nzulezu people also explained that it was their snail deity that sort of led them to the river. I would want to challenge the Nzulezu idea because the point is, it's a kingdom. You just don't enter a kingdom and then inhabit anywhere you wanted to. On the other hand, another question that remains very, very critical is you can be asked to live in the middle of water, but it's also your choice to live there. And importantly, your choice to remain in the middle of water to date. And I think that is the question that we need to explore.
Building a sustainable habitat in the middle of water is going to require a pretty good amount of engineering skill. Do we have any idea if these people had already acquired those skills previously when they lived elsewhere, or was this something they quickly figured out for themselves once they were in this environment?
That I would want to say probably not. Because the savanna region, besides the Niger, you wouldn't have huge bodies of water within the Sahel or the interior part of Western Africa. And even on the Gold Coast, and according to their journeys, how I trace them, they are not really encountering large bodies of water. And by the way, the water that they live on now is called the Amanzule River. So they are coming into contact with the Amanzule River would have been not a new phenomenon to them, but it's different living on the banks of a river and living in the middle of the river. And so going to live in the middle of the river would be quite different and expectedly extremely challenging. From my research, I understand that the king must have given them a piece of land to first settle on. And that is very reasonable because they can't just up and live on the water. My study points me to the northern banks of the river. There is a town called Ahumasuazu. And according to history, the ancestors possessed the land. And also, according to the records of Henry Meredith, that British official, he explains that the king gave them a parcel of land, but also asked them to move into the middle of the river. So it kind of suggests that they must have been given a piece of land to prepare and then move eventually into the middle of the water. And I argue that it must have been this Ahumasuazu space and this adjoining territory called Jamazu, where they currently have farms. They would have prepared their stilt houses, canoes, prepared all of that there before they moved ultimately into the middle of the river. And so they would have built their scaffolds, they would have cut down bamboos and other things. And they have a very fascinating story about that. We do not know for sure, but from oral traditions that I've collected from the community, the people would have first used bamboos. As newcomers, they wouldn't have had a lot of resources like metals. We're talking about the mid-18th century, and you are a traveling group. You may have guns, fine. You may have certain properties, but to have abundance of resources might be challenging. So they would have maybe borrowed from their neighboring Apollonian towns to cut down bamboos. I think bamboos would make sense because that is easy to work with. And then later would have advanced to large timbers like azobe, which actually grow within Apollonia. And by the way, Apollonia falls within the tropical rainforest region of the continent, and it has these huge timbers within the continent. And so it becomes very convenient for them. In fact, the Ahumasuazu area even was a site where these trees grew. And so because they inhabited the northern part of the river, their first settlement was erected around the northern banks of the river. On that side of the river, it's very open to tempest wind. Whenever they lit fire to cook and to illumine their environment, the wind would inflame the fire, blow it out of proportion. Because they used flammable materials like palm fronds to sort of roof their buildings and dry bamboos and all of that, it would catch fire. What they experienced was wildfire during the early years on the river, on the northern banks. So it is written in records that their initial houses were built separately from one another. That is a very great survival strategy because if we are nucleated and one person's house catches fire, it is going to spread. So they
Right.
had to build their houses separately from one another and use canoes as the means of communication. You need to be very safe on the water to be able to survive. So if you are faced with fire, you must first find a solution to that. So one thing they did was find another spot on the water that would be safe, and that is where they live now. It is explained that one of their elders went fishing on the southern part of the river, which is also occupied by raffia palm vegetation. And let me digress a little bit. The Amanzule River is huge. What we see is just a fraction of it. It sort of runs very, very wide and empties itself into the Atlantic Ocean. And so it forms part of this huge mangrove that has plants growing in them. And the raffia palm is one of them. And it's essentially a vegetation. They realized that if they were to construct a new settlement, tuck it into the raffia palm, they will shield themselves from the tempest wind. So they had to move their community from that northern side to the southern side. We do not know when they did that. We can speculate that that would have happened probably in the early decades of the 20th century. You can imagine the kind of survival strategies or the survival mechanisms they would have used to endure fire outbreak on the water for several decades. The water, it was not only inhabited by raffia palm, but it had fauna too. Of course, it would have fish, but it had pythons and it had crocodiles. It still does have crocodiles. And so is lizard people enter into an ecosystem that is virgin to human habitation, but already settled by other reptilian and even mammalian and amphibian animals. And so now the question becomes, how do we negotiate this waterscape? They first had to recreate the environment they came to meet by intentionally moving these animals to set or circumscribing these animals to certain spaces so that they would inhabit other spaces for security reasons. They intentionally embark on hunting and intentional killings to sort of push these animals to certain spaces so that they would have their own space to live. This is how I theorize about it. They create what I call residential and non-residential spaces. And here I am favoring human beings as the locus of culture on this waterscape. That's why I call it residential, because they are the center of my discussion. So they create a place that was inhabitable for humans. And a non-residential would be for spaces where animals lived. They have a place called Meander. That is the space for crocodiles. And pythons have moved far eastward, that they don't even come close to the river. They go out there to hunt for crocodiles, but crocodiles do not come into their territory. So in other words, they pushed animals into non-residential zones and they lived in residential zones. So they have the ability to enter the non-residential zone at will. But animals, especially dangerous ones, do not frequently invade their residential zones. I should say this. The raffia palm vegetation serves as home to animals like monkeys too. But because the lizard community is tucked behind the raffia palm, that space is very, very blurred. Essentially, you can imagine yourself having a tree behind you and there's a bird on it. The tree is essentially in your space, and the bird is in that space. And so you'd have monkeys coming into the lizard community at dawn and at night to steal some food stuff from their kitchen. So there, I complicate my own idea that, well, this same residential and non-residential zones are just ideological, because both humans and animals could sort of frequently enter each space. But for the sake of their survival, they intentionally push the dangerous ones, the crocodiles, pythons, snakes, very, very far from their space. So that one becomes one of the strategies of survival. And through that, what they do is that they reconfigure, quote unquote, a virgin waterscape into what was much more habitable and safe for them to live within. Another strategy of survival was through their economic occupations. And as we can imagine, they needed to eat and survive. And so what they do is that they have farms on land, precisely Ahomasuazo, which I mentioned earlier, and then the adjoining town called Jamazu, which is quite forested. So you would have females doing a lot of farming in these areas, Ahomasuazo and Jamazu, although males have farms too, but males predominantly do fishing. What we see there is gendered occupation. The males also produce palm wine and hard liquor. And then what happens is that they sell the gin, what we call locally as akweteshe. In fact, they boast that Nzlezu's akweteshe or hard liquor is the most powerful. I don't drink, so I've never tasted that, so I cannot really attest to that, but they are really good at that. They tap it from the raffia palm plants. On land, you need to fall a palm tree to do it, but they do not fall it, because when they fall it, it's getting into the water. So they tap it from the trunk of the tree. It's another technological feat. What we see here is this. In the economic sphere, females are into subsistence farming, bringing home the cassava, the tomato. Males are bringing in fish. What they do is that they sell the surplus to the larger Apollonian community. So much that in the mid-19th century, one European writer writes that Nzlezu people were the number one producers of tilapia for Apollonia. The Amanzuli River contains tilapia. So it becomes a huge source for river food for Apollonia. One of the reasons why Nzlezu people came to the river was also to obtain ready access to fresh water and to gain access to edible and non-edible water resources like fish. And so that was also a motivating factor besides their spiritual reason.
I previously did an episode on Benin, or as it was at the time, Dahomey, and I'm aware of another community who built similar stilt houses on water specifically because they were trying to avoid slave traders and people raiding and kidnapping their women and children. Was the slave trade a factor, do you think, in the establishment of this community?
It was not necessarily because of the slave trade. Well, they wanted security. It is believed that groups that established their communities in hard-to-access spaces, including mountaintops in the middle of water like in Zilezo, they did so to evade the Atlantic slave trade. And so a typical example is the Gambier community. The Gambier community was established as a security measure against Atlantic slave trade. But in a separate article that I have worked on, I argue that Apollonia was probably the only place on the Gold Coast where the Atlantic slave trade did not thrive. Because throughout the Atlantic slave trade era, only 352 people were shipped from Apollonia to the Americas. Whereas places like Elmina, Cape Coast, and Mabu Accra, they conveyed more than 100,000 people. And so slavery or that protection wouldn't have been the number one reason, because you're already in a very relatively insulated space. What Inslezu's story tells us is that while the slave trade was very, very paramount, it shaped political economies, it shaped the geography of Western Africa, but that wasn't the only reason that was shaping people's ideas and reasons for living in spaces. In fact, I call attention to the fact that we need to approach people's life in a more complex way and not only see through the lenses of the slave trade.
How were they impacted by colonialism?
I am yet to come across records that sort of suggests a very strong hand colonial control in Islam. Colonialism was all about exploitation. There were ideas of, civilizing the African native, constructing schools and all of that. It was all about exploitation. So anything and everything that would help the metropole to really get the best out of their colonies was very, very much accepted and encouraged. And so you see the imposition of taxes and the construction of railroads, they were all geared toward the benefit of the metropole. But in the case of Inslezu, because of their geographical location, they become very hard to access. In the region of Apollonia, Europeans came there at a very late hour. The first time Europeans were invited to establish a base there was in the 1760s. If you compare that to Elmina, Portuguese came there in 1471. From the 1760s to 1850s, late 1850s, you wouldn't have Europeans gaining adequate demographic knowledge of Apollonia. In other words, Europeans were not able to even get into the interior part of Apollonia until the late 1850s. And they did so for tax purposes, for control purposes. Inslezu is within the middle of Apollonia and in the middle of water, so hard to access. So their geographical location invariably insulates them from some of these things. In fact, when I was doing research there, I was told that up until recently, and recently would be the 2000s, when tourism began at Inslezu, you wouldn't just up and go to Inslezu. Before you get to Inslezu, you needed a canoe. And the canoe would probably belong to someone within the community. Then they'd come and fetch you from the banks of the river and take you into the community. And that was also a means of protecting themselves. And that strategy had existed throughout the pre-colonial times. Because in the records, it is said that these people were very secluded. They wouldn't even intermingle with Apollonian subjects. And it goes way back to support Meredith's idea that King Amishia didn't want them to mingle with Apollonian people. And so Inslezu upheld that rule all the way to recently, the 2000s. And so to go to Inslezu, they had to invite you in. You could get to the banks of the river. You would have to paddle a canoe for about 40 minutes to get to the community. If you were to use an outboard motor canoe, it would take you roughly 15 to 20 minutes. So it's quite a journey. They controlled who came in and who did not. I want to believe that their geographical location played a very, very huge role in insulating them from some of these broader historical happenings and processes.
In recent years, tourism has started to take off in this area. So potentially there's financial benefits to that. But at the same time, when you think of a place like Venice, which is a much larger, much more established city, that's having real problems with sinking just because of the volume of tourists that are going there. Has tourism had negative ramifications?
Then you asked a very, very important question that is very, very passionate to me too. So in the year 2000, UNESCO nominated Nsleso as a World Heritage Site. I should mention this. It was a nomination. Nsleso did not win. And since then, the government of Ghana transformed the community into a tourist attraction. The government collaborated with the people. And before then, people were coming to visit Nsleso anyways. Nsleso people themselves regulated that informal tourism thing taking place. But with UNESCO's nomination, it becomes more formalized. The government gets involved. But what we see is that it wouldn't be the tourism or section of the Ghanaian government. In other words, not the Ghana Tourism Authority or the Ghana Ministry of Tourism and Culture that would regulate tourism in Nsleso. It would be the Ghana Wildlife Society. And I want to emphasize the Wildlife Society. There is a reason to that. The Wildlife Society is an NGO, a private one, was already undertaking its own research projects within the broader Amanzule mangrove, which the Nsleso have in part. Nsleso far, 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 far precede the Wildlife Society. But the Wildlife Society begins a research in this space. Nsleso is already there. And so they invariably collaborate or take up this tourism activity with Nsleso people together with leaders from this society. So there was some level of cost sharing and then profit sharing. When I started my research, I discovered that profits were not trickling down to Nsleso as it should. And the sad thing is that the coming of several people into the community also wreaked a lot of damages to the infrastructure. You build a house or a walkway from wood, timber, that should accommodate, say, 400 people. And by the way, Nsleso people, their population does not exceed 400, but they do have a lot of their relatives living in the Ahafo-Suazo area that I mentioned. So I just want to clarify that. But if you have people, tourists, local and international tourists coming in almost every day, especially during festivities like Christmas, Islamic holidays, and other ones, you have a lot of pressure on these amenities. When tourists come, they litter around. They dispose of their plastic cans and water bottles and those sort of things. What that happens is they collect beneath the stilt houses. And as little people would have the burden to clean up after tourists. And we are not having profits also coming in as they should. I remember that in 2017, when I began research there, I was very fortunate to be there when the then tourism minister of Ghana, Honorable Catherine Ofeku, visited Nsleso, and one of the community leaders had opportunity or seized the opportunity, I'll say, to sort of voice out that, listen, you guys are not treating us fairly. You guys are treating us as though we were some wild animals in a wild mangrove. Because why would you allow the Ghana Wildlife Society instead of the Ghana Tourism Authority to regulate tourism in our community? And besides, we are not getting the profits coming from this one, and we are still bearing the brunt of the consequence, the effects of this. So this has been a major challenge. I would also say that there have been some significant developments there. For instance, they have a school, and they have a what we call primary school. I think it comes all the way to class six. There was a collaboration between, I think, the Korean government or an institution from Korea, the Ghana government, to construct a biotech public toilet or restroom there, which was to reprocess human waste into something solid and sort of not contaminate the river. Let me put it that way. But it broke down before long. They are trying to also improve the walkways, but I think that the burden falls on the shoulders of the Nsleso people. After that 2017 interaction, there have been an ongoing interaction to the point where the Ghana Wildlife Society is no more involved in tourism in Nsleso. That Nsleso people, and then I think the Ghana Tourism Department are sort of figuring out a way. because tourism serves as one of the major preoccupation now. Most of the gentlemen in the community serve as tour guides. It's a huge thing for them. I remember the elder, and I don't want to mention the name, saying that it quite appears as though we are in a zoo. You wake up in the morning and you have people swooping in and your privacy and those kind of things. And again, this is a changing idea of space and self and all of that, because in a pre-colonial, they wouldn't really be experiencing this. We are in different times and they live a very perfect life. It's a very peaceful place, very beautiful place, and very fun. There is no dull moment in Isolezo. There is always music. You can dance your heart out. It's so beautiful. But with tourism coming in, I don't think that the entire population opposes tourism, but the way it is constructed becomes a big challenge. And in terms of climate change, I should say this, that almost every 2 years, they experience some flooding, or even every year. I think it's becoming almost like every year, they experience flooding. When it happens, what happens is that water levels rise so much that it floods the walkway and comes into their rooms, that they cannot sleep there. They move out of the community, wait until it recedes, then they go back to replenish stuff. So I think that we should applaud them for surviving, living in a very, very physically challenging environment. It is different to live on land and even along the banks of a river. And it's very, very different to live in the middle of water. I remember when I was doing research there, I would be on my phone, and then one of them told me, "Hey, did you realize that you are in Isolezo, right? When you accidentally drop your phone, it is not coming back. It is not on land." And that was when it hit me. I'm like, "Oh, yeah, your space is very limited. You can't just run around as you want. Well, you can run on the walkway, but you can't just run around as you want in circles." And it's a very, very physically challenging space. But the people have adapted, sustained, or continued culture and retained history. And so Isolezo becomes a very, very good example for me to sort of flesh this out, because it tells of how humans have really endured over environmental shifts over time. But I also want to say that I'm encouraging anyone who wants to visit Ghana to go to Isolezo. People tend to believe that they are, quote unquote, backward. Why would they live in the middle of water? I think it's a very, very false idea. It's also a very narrow view. So why should they also live on land, if I were to ask you? Because they have DStv, they have electricity, they choose to live in the middle of water. And that's their choice, and that's their culture. And I always say that the reason why they remain on the water is much more important than why they would just choose to live there. And maybe I would want to end with this. There is this idea that they project that the Amanzule River, which is personified as a god, also called Amanzule, took care of their ancestors. And so now it is their turn to take care of the water too. And this speaks to one of the reasons why they choose to remain underwater, because for crying out loud, they have land elsewhere, Almaswazo and Jamaso, but still, some of them choose to live in the middle of the water. And for me, as a scholar, this is how I interpret it, that they are literally exhibiting or expressing a very significant Akan philosophy about reciprocity and caregiving. There is an Akan proverb that says this: your parents, particularly your mother, would take care of you to grow teeth. And then when they are old enough, you would take care of them for their teeth to fall out. In other words, contrary to what several Western societies do by taking their elderly people to an elderly home, we take care of our own. That is where we pamper them. That is where we make them feel like it is good that you invested in me. And I theorize about that as a reciprocal caregiving system amongst the Akan people. But in the case of Inzulus, what they do is that they express this in relationship to a deity, which they believe took care of their ancestors way before the present Inzulus people were born. And now, if tourists are coming in and spreading dirt or polluting the water, it is their duty to take care of it. Even though their communities are going to flood, it is their duty to take care of it, because they have a very, very strong and complex relationship with the water deity, and they have a reason and a responsibility to take care of their environment. And I think this is something worth studying, worth exploring. And it's very, very, very honorable. They are occupying a very, very special space on planet Earth that so many people would not want to.